When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Now it's time for The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell. Good evening, Lawrence.
Good evening, Mehdi. And what did it feel like for you as a father getting that news today about vaccination for children?
So minutes before I went live on this show, I quickly rang my wife and said, I'm going live on TV. Can you try and book an appointment for our daughter tomorrow as soon as possible? We're in the soon as possible camp. And I really feel for the parents of under fives who are waiting for the first shot for their kids.
Yeah, they, it has been a long wait. Well, I'm glad it's there for your daughter. Thank you, Mehdi.
Thanks.
Thank you. Well, The Washington Post gets it. The Washington Post understands the threat, the enormity of the threat to the United States delivered by Pennsylvania's Republican voters Tuesday night. In an editorial under the headline, After the Pennsylvania Primary, the Threat to U.S. Democracy Rises, The Washington Post says, quote, Republican voters overwhelmingly nominated State Senator Doug Mastriano, one of the country's most ardent deniers of the 2020 presidential election result. If Mr. Mastriano is elected in November, he could directly threaten U.S. democracy going forward. That's all it takes to destroy the absurdly fragile electoral machinery that produces a winner in American presidential elections. Just one person. That's all it takes. One breathtakingly ignorant, pathological liar. That's all it takes to end any semblance of democracy in presidential elections. Pennsylvania State Senator Doug Mastriano was at Donald Trump's January 6th rally and was seen near the grounds of the Capitol after Donald Trump told everyone to march to the Capitol and that he would march with them. After Donald Trump told them to fight like hell, Doug Mastriano was at the Capitol, at minimum, watching them fight like hell. He is under investigation by the January 6th committee. The committee subpoenaed him. He has not responded to the subpoena. And now we know that Attorney General Merrick Garland's Justice Department is conducting a criminal investigation of the same elements that the January 6th committee is investigating. And so Doug Mastriano, Republican candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, might be under federal criminal investigation right now for his attempts to overturn the presidential election. And Pennsylvania Republican voters say that's exactly who we want in charge of the next presidential election in Pennsylvania. Now, we don't normally think of governors as being in charge of elections because they are not supposed to be. At most, in some states, a governor's signature appears on a form certifying the electoral result. The Washington Post says that Mastriano would do much more than that. Quote, there is little doubt he would use his authority to reject free and fair election results should the voters favor a Democratic candidate. In Pennsylvania, the governor appoints the Secretary of State. And so if election liar Doug Mastriano is elected governor of Pennsylvania, he will also be the de facto Secretary of State of Pennsylvania because he will appoint a Secretary of State who will do exactly what he wants and overturn the election outcome in Pennsylvania if a Democrat wins the presidential election there. And a Republican-controlled Congress could then accept the fake electors sent by an election criminal operating as Pennsylvania's governor. None of this could be happening if we did not live under the immoral plague the founders called the Electoral College. The Electoral College is a standing crime against democracy. It never got in the way of democracy until the year 2000 because the winner of the most votes in the presidential election always turned out to be the winner of the most electoral votes in the Electoral College. Then came George W. Bush, installed as president by the Electoral College after coming in second to Al Gore with American voters. 16 years later, the same happened for Donald Trump, who came in an even more distant second to Hillary Clinton with voters. The Republican Party and Republican presidential candidates like Donald Trump have no possible plan to ever win the most votes in a presidential campaign again. They've given up on that. The only way Donald Trump can be, can become president again is by winning the Electoral College or by stealing the Electoral College. And so Donald Trump has endorsed the Republican nominee for governor in Pennsylvania who tried to steal the Electoral College for Donald Trump once before. Much of the democratic structure that the founders created in this country has been copied in newer democracies around the world. The one thing that no other country in the world has ever adopted is the Electoral College, because it is so obviously recognized worldwide as a crime against democracy. Each of the 50 states is a democracy. Governors are elected in a purely democratic election. So are mayors. So are United States senators. It is only in presidential elections that voters don't get their way. One Republican in Colorado now wants to institute an electoral college within the state of Colorado for the election of governor of Colorado, because Republicans see no other way to win a statewide election for governor of Colorado. No plot to steal a presidential election could work without the Electoral College. Therefore, we should obviously abolish the Electoral College, but we never will, because that requires a constitutional amendment, which requires a two-thirds vote in the House and the Senate, and that will never happen. The Washington Post is urging action on reforming the Electoral Count Act of 1887 so that it would be more difficult to steal an Electoral College victory in the states or in Congress. Senator Chris Murphy, who is working on that bill, told the Washington Post, "Hopefully, the Pennsylvania results crystallize the coming threat." According to a new report by a group of voting rights organizations, in the first 4 months of this year, 229 bills were introduced in 33 states that would allow state legislatures to meddle in elections. The report concludes, left unchecked, these legislative proposals threaten to paralyze the smooth functioning of elections. Election administrators could be left powerless to stop voter intimidation. Election rules could devolve into a confusing and contradictory tangle, subject to change at the whims of partisan lawmakers. Election results could be endlessly called into question and subjected to never-ending destructive reviews conducted based on no responsible standard. At the extreme, election results could simply be tossed aside and the will of the people ignored. That is what the Republican nominee for governor in Pennsylvania tried to do in 2020 and will do if elected governor. If the Democratic nominee for governor in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, is elected governor, he will appoint a Secretary of State who will do what every Pennsylvania Secretary of State has always done, follow the law, and report the honest count of votes in the election and certify the candidate with the most votes as the winner. The Washington Post says, nothing else matters. Quote, general election voters must reject candidates who, either through delusion or partisan calculation, deny valid election results. Inflation, the Ukraine war, gasoline prices, the COVID-19 pandemic, none of these issues are as important as preserving the democratic order. Americans should vote like it. Today, the Senate Rules Committee, chaired by Senator Amy Klobuchar, had a hearing on election integrity. Testifying at that hearing today were secretaries of state, election officials, and experts, including Leah Chapman, the acting Secretary of State of Pennsylvania, who will join our discussion tonight.
It is especially disturbing that some disinformation has come from those with a sworn duty to defend our democratic process. The November 2020 election in Pennsylvania, like every election since, was free, fair, and secure. Allegations of illegal activity in Pennsylvania's 2020 presidential election have been repeatedly dismissed in more than two dozen federal court cases and debunked by independent fact checkers. Repeating this falsehood over and over harms our democracy and voters' confidence in our elections process.
Joining us now, Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs. She is the Democratic candidate for governor of Arizona. Also with us, Lee Chapman, acting Pennsylvania Secretary of State. She testified at today's Senate Rules Committee hearing on the administration of upcoming elections. And Secretary Chapman, let me begin with you, since the focus in the Washington Post editorial is on your state of Pennsylvania. You testified today at the Senate Rules Committee. Is there anything that can be done in Pennsylvania law to limit the discretion that might be available to a secretary of state or a governor in Pennsylvania on voting results?
I mean, certainly there's many different things that can be done in Pennsylvania law. But as the law stands right now, as the secretary of state, I am responsible for certifying the election. And that's something that is in the Pennsylvania Election Code. And unless that changes, you know, I am in charge of certifying all election results after the counties certify those election results.
And Secretary Hobbs, we are seeing an assault on this process all over the country. We just heard that accounting of the number of bills that have been introduced to try to allow Republican legislatures and Republican governors to interfere with the result. The focus is on Pennsylvania this week, but how many other states do you think are at risk for this kind of tampering?
Well, there states across the country are at risk. There are so many parallels between the gubernatorial race in Pennsylvania and the one here in Arizona. The frontrunner in the Republican primary has been endorsed by Donald Trump and espouses many of the same extreme positions as the nominee in Pennsylvania, saying that we should decertify the 2020 election, fully buying into Trump's big lie, refusing to say whether or not she would certify the 2024 election. And we're seeing this in elections across the country. Every voter should be concerned that those who are seeking positions of oversight of our democratic and electoral systems are the very same people undermining them.
Secretary Chapman, in the state of Pennsylvania, would laws have to be changed in order for a secretary of state or a governor to actually interfere with the vote count in the state?
Yes, I mean, laws would have to be changed through the election code or through a constitutional amendment. But, you know, we're in the process of, you know, counting results from Tuesday's primary election. So, you know, voters really need to feel confident on the integrity of the elections. You know, we need to make sure that the process plays out. Yes, that could happen in the future, but where it stands right now and where the law currently stands is that the Secretary of State, who's appointed by the governor, that's me, you know, I have the authority to certify the election results. And that's what I'm going to do once I receive those certified results and from the counties relatively soon.
Secretary Hobbs, you want to move from Secretary of State to governor. Which one of those positions should voters be more concerned about when it comes to election integrity?
Well, voters should be concerned about all of these positions because no one actor can act alone and undo the election results. But acting in concert should Carrie Lake be elected and an actual insurrectionist running for Secretary of State here be elected. They could certainly work together to implement Trump's plans to overturn the 2024 election. No matter what position it is, democracy is on the ballot in 2022. And that's why I'm running and I need folks' help at katiehobbs.org to make sure that we are protecting our democracy in every way possible.
Secretary Chapman, when do you think Pennsylvania will have a result in the Republican Senate primary?
Sure. So the latest numbers that I have are that we have about 35,200 ballots, mail-in ballots that are still being counted right now from 10 different counties. And so I'm sure a lot of people have heard about what was happening in Lancaster County regarding the 22,000 ballots that had the barcode error. I was told this evening that all of those votes have been counted. So they're complete with that count with the 22,000 ballots. So the next step in the process is tomorrow at 9 a.m. Elections boards meet to canvass ballots. Then on Tuesday, by 5 p.m., counties will send me their unofficial results. And as we all know, the statewide Senate race, the United States Senate race, is, you know, within that 0.5% margin right now for a potential recount. So after I receive those unofficial results, I'll make a determination as to whether or not there will be an unofficial, an actual automatic statewide recount in Pennsylvania. And so we'll make that announcement midweek next week, Wednesday or Thursday. So that's where it is. You know, I just want to reiterate that people need to let the process play out. You know, it's important that election officials count every vote, and that's what they're doing right now. They're doing their jobs to count every vote to make sure that every Pennsylvania's voice is heard.
And what would be the timetable for a recount if a recount occurs?
So counties have to start by June 1st, and it should be completed by June 7th. So it's about a week. But, you know, one thing to note is that counties, when they do the recount, they can't do it in the same method as how votes were counted the first time. So they have to use a different type of equipment for that recount. But the election code requires from June 1st to June 7th, so a week.
Acting Secretary of State of Pennsylvania, Lee Chapman, and Secretary of State of Arizona, Katie Hobbs, thank you both very much for starting off our discussion tonight. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And coming up, what Donald Trump was doing at the White House while his mob was attacking the Capitol to overthrow the presidential election and, as they were saying, hang Mike Pence. The January 6th committee now has photographic evidence that could answer the question of what was Donald Trump doing. That's next.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Today's news requires more facts, more context, and more analysis. The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Caught on camera. That's the way Republicans must be feeling now. Today we learned that the January 6th committee has on-camera evidence against Republicans from then President of the United States to members of Congress. Politico is reporting that the January 6th committee has obtained official White House photographs from the National Archives that, quote, may provide the committee with real-time visual evidence of former President Donald Trump's actions and movements as a mob of his supporters battered their way into the Capitol. Axios is reporting that former Attorney General William Barr is in active discussions to appear before the January 6th committee for a transcribed interview. The January 6th committee revealed today that it has evidence that Georgia Republican Congressman Barry Loudermilk led a tour of the Capitol the day before the January 6th attack. In a letter requesting Representative Loudermilk's voluntary cooperation with the investigation, the committee said, "You have information regarding a tour you led through parts of the Capitol complex on January 5th, 2021. The committee's letter made reference to public comments by other members of Congress who believed they witnessed tours being given that seemed like reconnaissance tours. That's what New Jersey Representative Mikey Sherrill called what she saw, and she described that on this program.
I'm a former Navy helicopter pilot, and I've served all over the world. So we're trained to alert, to report things that are unusual or don't seem right. And certainly when the Capitol was closed to visitors, to have those tours going through the Capitol, and then to see what happened on January 6th, I reported that the coordinated effort that went into planning January 6th went far deeper than I think many of us had anticipated.
The committee's letter to Representative Loudermilk says, In response to those allegations, Republicans on the Committee on House Administration, of which you are a member, claimed to have reviewed security footage from the days preceding January 6th and determined that there were no tours, no large groups, no one with MAGA hats on. However, the Select Committee's review of evidence directly contradicts that denial. Joining our discussion now, Glenn Kirshner, former federal prosecutor and MSNBC legal analyst. Glenn, let's begin with the first point raised, which is the caught-on-camera situation. January 6th committee apparently now has official White House photographs of Donald Trump during the attack on the Capitol. And I have seen many times in the White House the way the official White House photographers always behave, and they are just a constant presence in every room the president goes into. They become part of the wallpaper. They're clicking away nonstop at everyone in the room with always a focus on the president. So there's a lot of photographic evidence of that day.
Yeah, Lawrence, and the more vivid a picture that the January 6th committee can paint for us all when the public hearings open on June 9 of what Donald Trump was doing for 187 minutes, while his angry mob that he set on the Capitol was attacking the Capitol, was hunting for politicians. It's going to be really damning because what we already know, but you know, pictures have a way of really driving it home. What we already know is that for 3 hours, people were streaming into the Oval Office trying to convince the president to call off, let's call it what it is, his attack, and he refused to do it. Keith Kellogg, the national security advisor to Mike Pence, said, you know what? We even sent Ivanka Trump back into the Oval Office a second time to try to convince her father to call off the attack. And he wouldn't. Lawrence, I'm sorry, but we have to call that what it is. That was Donald Trump waging war for 3 hours on the democratic process, trying to stop the certification of Joe Biden's win. And if we can see it with our own eyes, as captured in photographs, not only testimony, which we will see beginning on June 9, it is going to be a powerful presentation.
Let's listen to what Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary at the time, what she said about what Donald Trump was doing that we will probably see in the White House photographs.
All I know about that day was that he was in the dining room gleefully watching on his TV, as he often did, look at all of the people fighting for me, hitting rewind, watching it again. That's what I know.
And Glenn, still photographs can tell that story.
Yeah, the word gleefully jumps out. And it's horrific that we were all watching it and that anybody could watch it gleefully, regardless of your political persuasion, your ideology, that you could be watching it gleefully, knowing you were the only person who likely could put a stop to it. The Capitol Police couldn't put a stop to it because the Capitol was deprived of enough federal law enforcement resources to repel the attack Donald Trump had launched. And watching it gleefully and refusing to put a stop to it, even though people were pleading with you to do just that, you know, I think, Lawrence, once we see this with our own eyes in these public hearings, we see the crimes that were committed. We see the evidence that can prove those crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. The only next reasonable step for a responsible government is for Donald Trump to be indicted for his crimes.
We also see from the January 6th committee that they apparently have video of Representative Barry Loudermilk giving a tour on January 5th. They've put that in writing in their letter to him after he had been part of a public denial that anything like that happened. And that for them to want to use it, there would have to be something in that video that is not just him showing a Boy Scout troop around the building.
Yeah, and there is no innocent explanation if Representative Loudermilk is proved to have lied and concealed the fact that he was giving tours. I hesitate to call them reconnaissance tours. But if he was giving tours of the Capitol to anyone on January 5th, when the Capitol was virtually shut down to visitors due to COVID protocols, there is no innocent explanation for why he would hide that, why he would be hiding that for so long from everybody. So I'll be interested to see exactly what kind of evidence is produced.
And Glenn, before we go, Attorney General William Barr, former Attorney General, working out, it sounds like, an agreement to speak with the January 6th committee.
Yeah, and let me start with a caveat. If Bill Barr's word is to be credited, you know, we know that he's been on his reputation rehabilitation tour selling books, and he has said, among other things, that on December 1st, he told the president that your claim, Mr. President, of election fraud is, to paraphrase Bill Barr, BS. And what that does, Lawrence, is that provides powerful evidence of Donald Trump's criminal intent every day moving forward from December 1st, when his own attorney general said your claims of election fraud are BS. And yet Donald Trump continued to peddle them. What does that do? It provides evidence of his corrupt intent.
Glenn Kirshner, thank you very much for joining us again tonight.
Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you. Coming up today, Vice President Kamala Harris objected to the latest state law restricting abortion, this time in Oklahoma.
Think about that for a second. From the moment of fertilization, it's outrageous, and it's just the latest in a series of extreme laws around the country.
That's next.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Today, Oklahoma's state legislature approved a bill that bans abortion beginning at the moment of fertilization. The bill says, quote, fertilization means the fusion of a human spermatozoon with a human ovum. The bill also defines an unborn child this way. Unborn child means a human fetus or embryo in any stage of gestation from fertilization until birth. The only exceptions to the absolute ban on abortion are to save the life of a mother or in cases of rape and incest that have been reported to police. The law allows citizen bounty hunters to sue anyone involved in any way in helping a woman obtain abortion services. Today, Vice President Kamala Harris said this.
Think about that for a second. From the moment of fertilization, it's outrageous, and it's just the latest in a series of extreme laws around the country. The strength of our country has always been that we fight to move forward, that we believe in the expansion of rights, not the restriction of rights. So this, when and if it happens, will be an extreme step backward.
The House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the impact of restricting abortion access when the Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. Congresswoman Cori Bush said this.
When I was 17 years old, I was raped. Weeks later, I found out I was pregnant. Without the protections afforded to me by Roe v. Wade, I would have been forced to birth a human being that I could not take care of, and the father would have been my rapist. The emotional devastation of this encounter was traumatic. I didn't know if it was my fault. I didn't know what to do. Did I do something wrong? I hadn't consented, but I blamed myself. The stress of possibly having a child at 18 was more than I could bear.
Representative Lucy McBath said this.
After which failed pregnancy should I have been imprisoned? Would it have been after the first miscarriage? After doctors used what would be an illegal drug to abort the lost fetus? Would you have put me in jail after the second miscarriage? Perhaps that would have been the time. Forced to reflect in confinement at the guilt I felt, the guilt that so many women feel after losing their pregnancies. Or would you have put me behind bars after my stillbirth? I ask because if Alabama makes abortion murder, does it make miscarriage manslaughter?
Joining our discussion now is Dr. Iman Al-Sayedin. She is the medical director for Planned Parenthood Great Plains, which includes Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. She's also an OBGYN physician and fellow with the Physicians for Reproductive Health. Doctor, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Since your jurisdiction at Planned Parenthood includes Oklahoma, what is your reaction to a law saying that abortion is banned beginning at what they are calling the moment of fertilization?
First, thank you for having me, Lawrence. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. I agree with Vice President Harris. The law is ridiculous. It is cruel. We know that abortion is safe, essential, basic health care. And today, Oklahoma proved that they do not care about keeping us safe or healthy. The interest of Oklahoma politicians that was proven today is that they are interested in controlling and criminalizing people who have uteruses and the bodies of communities that are not white men, essentially.
So we are seeing a competition among Republican legislatures and Republican governors about who can come up with the most extreme abortion ban in a state. Oklahoma is a strong competitor here for this, but surely next week there'll be another one coming along that we can't even anticipate now. And this is the reality. This Roe versus Wade is going to be overturned by this Supreme Court. And on that day, all of these laws become active and effective.
That's completely correct. I do think that there is a trend right now amongst Republican-led states where they are prioritizing the control and coercion of people over the issues actually that should be addressed. For example, Oklahoma ranks among the lowest in maternal mortality. 1 in 5 Oklahoman children live in poverty. Oklahoma ranks 39th in the nation in gun violence and homicide. We are looking at a state that is not focused on the right things. They are not focused on people's health. They are not focused on facts and science and medicine. They are focused on control. For example, Representative Hamilton of the Oklahoma Senate said that House Bill 4327 didn't go far enough. He wanted it to also include ectopic pregnancies, which are a known life-threatening emergency. So we are dealing with medical misinformation that is rampant. It is uncontrollable. Medical misinformation killed thousands of people from COVID. And we are seeing medical information spread like wildfire in terms of abortion, which has proven time and time and time again to be safe, essential, basic healthcare. And quite frankly, it is your basic human right to control your own body.
Dr. Iman Al-Sayedin, thank you very much for helping us continue to cover this important story. Thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And coming up, another loss for Vladimir Putin today, with Sweden and Finland officially applying to become members of NATO. That means Sweden is finally breaking 188 years of neutrality to stand in opposition to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Ben Rhodes joins us next. Relegated to the dustbin of bad pundit history now are the oft-repeated assertions for years that turned out to be based on zero evidence that Vladimir Putin is smart. Vladimir Putin's immoral invasion of Ukraine now takes its place as the stupidest military decision made by a Russian leader since Joseph Stalin aligned with Adolf Hitler at the beginning of World War II, before switching sides after Hitler turned on Stalin. The Putin plan to weaken NATO by invading Ukraine has only made NATO stronger. And now Sweden, a country that has maintained military neutrality for almost 200 years, is applying to join NATO, as is Finland, which shares 800 miles of border with Russia. Today, after meeting with Finland's president and Sweden's prime minister, President Biden said this.
Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty. Let no one make a mistake. The meaning of this historic day. In the face of aggression, NATO has not grown weaker or more divided. It has grown stronger, more united. With Finland and Sweden's decision to request membership in NATO, it'll be enhanced for all time.
Today, the Senate finally passed, after a week of obstruction by Rand Paul, a $40 billion aid package for Ukraine, which includes military aid as well as aid funding for support of refugees, including English language instruction. The bill also includes $5 billion in global food aid to fill food shortages created by the collapse of Ukraine's vast agricultural output. 11 Republican senators, including Rand Paul, Joshua Hawley, and Mike Lee, voted against the aid package. Yesterday, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said, for Senator Paul to delay Ukraine funding for purely political motives is to only strengthen Putin's hand. Today, Chuck Schumer said the 11 Republican senators voting against the bill are, quote, using the same soft on Putin playbook used by former President Trump. On Tuesday, on the Senate floor, Senator Rand Paul proved that he has absolutely no comprehension of what war actually is when he said, yes, our national security is threatened not by Russia's war on Ukraine, but by Congress's war on the American taxpayer. Joining us now is Ben Rhodes, former Deputy National Security Advisor to President Obama and an MSNBC political analyst. He is the author of After the Fall, Being American in the World We've Made. Ben, this is quite a historic day. It's a thing we can say more than once a week these days. But to see Sweden, after 188 years, saying, yes, we finally do want to step out of neutrality into an alignment, and to see Finland shares an 800-mile border with Russia, saying, yes, we now want to be part of NATO. This is a moment that we couldn't have conceived of in January.
No, that's absolutely right, Lawrence. I mean, you have to consider that Finland and Sweden made it through the Cold War maintaining neutrality. Sweden stayed out of World War I and World War II. And Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine has precipitated this event. Vladimir Putin has become the single most important force for the enlargement of NATO. And if you look at his strategic war aims at the beginning of this war, they have failed spectacularly. He wanted to stop the expansion of NATO to Russia's borders. He just precipitated the doubling of NATO's border with Russia, with that Finnish border with Russia. He wanted to divide the West, which frankly had already been divided badly in the Trump year. Instead, he has done more to unify the United States and Europe and democratic nations around the world than anything that has happened in recent years. He wanted to subjugate and decapitate the Ukrainian government. And instead, he has a Ukrainian population that has made clear that they will never submit to any kind of Russian subjugation, and the Ukrainian government led by President Zelensky that has won the admiration of people around the world. So all of his strategic war aims have already failed catastrophically just in these early months of what is likely to be a long and grinding conflict.
In Finland, polling on joining NATO hovered around 20-30% for years. It now stands at over 70%. And that was, as you say, Vladimir Putin's strategic outcome here. When he had the troops amassed at the border of Ukraine, that was the it turns out that was the last moment where he had any negotiating strength at all. And he apparently didn't realize that.
No, he didn't, Lawrence. And clearly he didn't, because he thought that a kind of lightning move with this massive military force around Ukraine would lead to the rapid collapse of the Ukrainian government. And once the Ukrainian people and government stood strong against that move, his war aims essentially failed and he lost his leverage. And I think it's important to note, by the way, that those polling numbers mirror what happened in Ukraine. You used to have a minority of Ukrainians who wanted to join NATO, who wanted to orient this strongly towards the West. It was after the annexation of Crimea and the initial Russian invasion of the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine that you saw this significant uptick in Ukrainian support for NATO membership. That kind of populist sentiment really ultimately led to the election of President Zelensky, and we've seen how important that is. So time and again, what Vladimir Putin has done is overplay his hand in a way that has served to unify the Ukrainian people, you served to unify the Finnish people, and it served to unify people across democracies. Now, even as we are united in standing up for Ukraine, as the vote in Congress suggests today, we have a lot more work to be done within our own democracies if we're going to win an enduring competition with authoritarianism.
So the president asked Congress for $33 billion for Ukraine. Congress says, we'll give you 40, including a majority of Republican senators say, we will give you 40, more than you ask for. What does that do for the Biden approach to Ukraine strategically going forward?
Well, I think what's so important about this is that this is like a significant amount of funding that can sustain Ukraine for the next 6 months. This is not like just a Band-Aid that we're rushing assistance in. And by sending this signal at a time when Ukraine, in many ways, has a significant amount of momentum in this conflict, although they have areas like Mariupol, obviously, where they've lost territory, by signaling this American commitment, not only are we going to be able to sustain the Ukrainian military and governmental effort, but it sends a message to the rest of NATO, to the rest of Ukraine supporters, that they should stay in this fight as well.
Ben Rhodes, thank you very much for joining us again tonight.
Thanks, Arne.
Tonight's Last Word is next. During today's Senate Rules Committee hearing on election administration, civil rights attorney Damon Hewitt said this.
This week marks the 65th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s famous speech, Give Us the Ballot, where he warned us about those who gain prominence and power by the dissemination of false ideas and deliberately appealing to the deepest hate responses within the human mind. I said earlier that democracy is a promise. Democracy is also a choice. We have a choice when it comes to election administration. We can either strengthen democracy and make it easier to vote and administer elections, or we can make it harder. As policymakers, you can make a choice in favor of democracy.
Attorney Damon Hewitt gets tonight's last word.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at MSNBC.com/app.